You're listening to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Lakshdatta. This episode is a live session from day 4 of Jaipur Lit Fest 2023, and it's called The Story of Art Without Men. Katie Hessel in conversation with Alex von Dunzelman.
For coming. Now, if any of you were at my session with David Olashoga 4,000 years ago on Friday, we were talking about statues, a particular part of art, but perhaps also an expression of power. And they were all about men. The only woman mentioned is Queen Victoria, who, let's be honest, didn't exactly get there on merit. So we were talking all about men. So how delicious, how delightful to be here with the brilliant Katie Hessel, talking about art without men. So, Katie, how did you get the idea to start thinking about art without men? What kicked this off?
Thank you so much, Alex, and thank you all so much for coming. So, 7 years ago, I had just finished my BA in art history, and something was on my mind that I felt like something was missing from art history. And in October 2015, I walked into an art fair, looked at thousands of artworks in front of me, and realized not a single one was by a woman. And then I said to myself, but could I even name 20 women artists off the top of my head? Could I name 10 pre-1850, any pre-1750? The answer was no. Had I essentially been looking at the history of art from a male perspective, essentially the history of patriarchy, the answer was yes. And so that night, I did what sort of any 21-year-old millennial would do, was I looked up the words women artists on Instagram, and nothing appeared. And so I literally couldn't sleep. And I had this epiphany, and I said, you know what, I'm gonna start an Instagram account, because I always think, use whatever resource you have in front of you. You know, it doesn't matter how much, you know, how little or much money you have, use what you have in front of you. So I started a blog called The Great Women Artists, very much paying homage to an amazing art historian in the 70s called Linda Nochlin, who in 1971, at the dawn of the feminist movement, wrote the essay, Why Have There Been No Great Women Artists, which really kickstarted this debate. And so 50 years on, it seemed that not much has changed. So I wanted to do something about it. And then, you know, I still update the blog on a daily basis. It's really a way for me to sort of use my knowledge to good use and challenge myself, find a different one every day. And then I started a podcast called The Great Women Artists Podcast, and now this book, which is The Story of Art Without Men.
Yes, you can just, if you look close up, it does say without men under The Story of Art, but almost disappearing. Goodbye, men. give us some context for sort of how... What is the underrepresentation of women in art? Is there a way you can kind of quantify that for us?
Absolutely. So the reason why this book, I mean, if you look closely, it says without men. It's based on a very famous book in England called The Story of Art by E.H. Gombrich, who was a fantastic scholar who wrote this incredible book called The Story of Art. And the first edition in 1950 was wonderful, but it had one very significant flaw. He didn't mention a single woman artist. Even the 16th edition, which came out in the 2000s, includes just one. So I thought something has to be done. And this is the introductory Bible to art history. If you're a teenager in England, you get this Bible. And how can you possibly look at the history of art from one perspective? We need to break down the canon. But also, we have to question, what are we even seeing in our museums? So London's National Gallery, for example, the heart of the nation, where we go to learn about history and those who came before us. If I tell you the statistic, you will be absolutely shocked. So just 1% of their collection is made up of art by women artists, which is absolutely shocking. Similarly, the Royal Academy in London, you know, a fantastic, prestigious, world-renowned museum. In 2023, they are yet to have a solo exhibition in their 250-year history in their main space by a woman artist. I mean, it's absolutely shocking.
Zero, literally zero women.
Zero women so far.
Years.
Exactly,
wow.
Exactly.
So well, there is so much to be done. The next 250 years, we should only have women.
I agree. I absolutely agree. So, but also, I mean, you know, this also acts as almost a microcosm for how we place monetary value on genders in society as well, considering that the highest earning woman artist living today, her work has just gone for 10% of the highest earning male artist. So to sort of give you those statistics, so much needs to be done.
Absolutely, and it is, I mean, very much in your book, you know, women artists are certainly disadvantaged, but this is absolutely also a story globally. It's also a story about women of colour are even more disadvantaged, queer women, you know, all sorts of women artists are really written out of this story, and we're certainly going to come to talk about some Indian artists later on. I think it's highly relevant in this context. But Casey, what's going on here? Okay, because now if you go back to John Ruskin, very famous art critic in the 19th century, he just said, well, no women can paint. So is this the thing? Are women just rubbish at art?
No! And actually, as recently as 2013, a very famous German expressionist called George Baselitz also said that women can't paint. So come on, guys, we need to support the women. I mean, you know, we have to also, you know, I was so fed up of reading about women artists in the context of men. You know, if we mention Dora Maar, the fantastic surrealist, why would we go to her retrospective at Tate Modern? Are there two rooms dedicated to Picasso, who she dated for about a decade? You know, where is she in his exhibitions? And so what I wanted to do is really root women in their social and political context, in the time in which we lived, which also gives voice to women and also questions people's barbaric statements like Ruskin. The reason why he probably said women can't paint is because he didn't think also about the context in which they were working. So, for example, when we think of going to the National Gallery, we think of these sort of grand, multi-figured, beautiful paintings of mythological and biblical scenes, visceral paintings. The only way that an artist could even, first of all, paint something like that was if they had anatomical accuracy, if they could study the nude from life, if they knew the human body. Women weren't admitted to the life room until the 1890s, and still women around the world are still hindered on so much education. I mean, there is just so much to be done. And so the thing is, when we are comparing, you know, a woman artist from the Baroque and a male artist from the Baroque, the thing is that, of course, you know, if we're looking at skill, a man might be more skillful in the traditional sense. But you have to think, these women overcame every single boundary just to have their names immortalized in art history. The odds were completely against them, especially in the 19th century, where Rousseau, you know, made it popular for women to be in the home and therefore not professional artists. And, you know, it's ridiculous.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think something that's so important and interesting you do in the book as well is challenging that canon, not just in terms of gender, but in terms of medium. In terms of, you know, we've been talking about painting, but I mean, there are many other forms of art and women's art.
Exactly. And, you know, when I read something like Gombrich's Story of Art, it really focuses on the high art, painting, sculpture, and architecture. When actually, what about quilting? What about textiles? What about pottery? What about gesso paneling? All these mediums are so worthy of being celebrated as high art or whatever that means. And so I think it's really important to break down that canon. Also, you know, when we're looking at a global art history, painting, sculpture, and architecture aren't necessarily, you know, considered high art. So, for example, let's look at 19th century America. Quilt making was completely in abundance. There was an extraordinary artist called Harriet Powers, who was born in 1837, into slavery. And in her later life, she was able to become a quilt maker. And the fact that this woman overcame so many barriers in her life, and two of her works remain, they're called Biblical Quilt. And what she does is she kind of put pieces together, these beautiful sort of stencil cutouts. Yet she wasn't recognized by this establishment until the 1970s, you know, 70 years after her death. The fact that these women just had to overcome so much. And also, it's also about breaking down the canon globally as well, but also how we tell the story of art. Because when I would also read academic texts of art history, you know, they can be quite dense. And art history is also a subject that has so often been seen as elitist. You know, this, what is this kind of mystical thing that is art? And actually, what's so important is that I want everyone to feel like that they could be part of this story. And so I also wrote this book in a very sort of accessible way that, you know, I really think that no one who's ever even stepped inside a museum can read it. It's about inviting everyone into that. And also, you know, if we're not seeing art by a wide range of people, then we're not seeing society as a whole. And the whole point of art history is to tell this visual history of the world, and it's rich and it's diverse and it's dense and it's brilliant. And so we're essentially what we've done in the past is celebrating this very narrow part of society. So I'm trying to open that up.
I mean, just a small task to get through. And let's, just before we go in and talk about some of these women artists you've written about and their kind of lives and work, can we just briefly focus on something you talk on in the book about, which is about misattribution? Mm. Because, you know, I mean, lots of people who, like me, read history or anything, are probably pretty used to some older books by men that will say at the beginning, I'm so grateful to my wife for typing this manuscript, at which point you read, writing half this manuscript. So is there something similar happening in the history of art?
Absolutely. And I mean, really, I mean, it all has come out in the last century. For example, in 1917, the Metropolitan Museum of Art bought a work that they thought was by Jacques-Louis David, the kind of leader of neoclassicism, for a staggering $200,000. And in the 70s, they realized it was actually by a woman artist called Marie Charpentier. And, you know, it's the fact that actually in the 50s, when art historians were commenting on it, sort of, just absolutely sort of divine essence, they then changed their mind and said, actually, you know, this actually isn't of the high caliber that David would paint. Of course it's by women. And actually that's completely barbaric, that we're sort of basing art and merit on gender, because at the end of the day, it's a fantastic picture. And I mean, the same happened to Frans Hals and Judith Leyster, a fantastic artist working in the Dutch Golden Age, because, you know, you mentioned the wife typing up her husband's manuscript. So much of the time, after a woman artist was married off to her husband, a lot of the time an artist himself, she was actually in his studio painting, and as a result he would then pass off his works as hers. So, you know, someone like Judith Leyster, who made these beautiful paintings in the 1620s and only had a very short career because she had to be married off with five kids immediately, you know, her name is just coming to light. And actually, in order to get around this kind of problem of misattribution, there are countless examples in the history of art of work by women that actually, when you look at a still life platter, perhaps kind of all these fruits and goblets sort of laid out in a delectable platter, look closely at some of the goblets and you will see hidden self-portraits within this. So there's a fantastic artist called Clara Peters working in the 17th century. And I love the fact that it's almost her saying, you cannot take this work as yours, it is mine. It's these people who are demanding their place in art history. And I think that's why also, you know, the question of self-portraits and signing as well. It's so important that, you know, people as overlooked, underappreciated, communities in the world, they make their mark in the world and they make that voice heard.
Well, I think self-portraiture actually, yes, absolutely deserving of some applause. Self-portraiture, now this is one of the bits of the book where I really did have one of those moments where your jaw just drops and you think, oh, okay, hold on, I need to rethink how I think about this. And I'm going to, a short quote from John Berger, a very famous artist and critic, sadly no longer with us, but I mean, he wrote brilliantly about the sort of gendering of art and very sympathetically. So a short quote from him, which kind of kicks this off, is, men survey women before treating them. Consequently, how a woman appears to a man can determine how she will be treated. To acquire some control over this process, women must contain it and interiorize it. Men look at women. Women watch themselves being looked at. So you come out of this and talk about self-portraiture. So self-portraiture is something quite radical for a woman, isn't it?
Totally. And, you know, to sort of paraphrase that, it's essentially men act and women appear. And as much as I am a complete Bergerite, the quote you're referencing is from a fantastic book called Ways of Seeing, but even John Berger in 1972, who I love with all my heart, even he actually failed to include or reference a single artwork by a woman. So actually, even his work, we're not seeing the full picture. And actually, if he had included some self-portraits by women, he would have found some radical work. So for example, in 1555, there was an extraordinary Italian artist called Sofonisba Anguissola. And in 1555, she painted her teacher dictating her appearance. So what we see, we first think it's her teacher, you know, painting her, but it's actually her dictating his appearance, dictating her. And she is painted 1.5 times as big as him. She's got him painting the embellishment of the jacket, which is something normally assigned to an apprentice. So what this woman is doing in 1555 is she's actually switching up gender conventions, which is radical. And if John Berger had included that, you know, we would know so much more, because also it's about, You know, so much of this as well is about the narrative of how we've told art history. And actually, we've looked at this such narrow path, and we need to open that up, because history of art has been told time and time and time again by white men. And actually, we need to have different perspectives. And, I say in the introduction to this book as well, I don't say that this is the definitive art history. It's just the history of art that I've grown up with and I've learned in my, you know, not very long life. And so I want to hear everyone else's version of art history, and I think that's what I want to encourage with it as well.
Well, I mean, that is the perfect jumping off point, that, you know, you're absolutely right that it's not just the history of art by men, but by white men and by white elite men. And here we are, sitting in the incredible India. I mean, let's talk a little bit about Indian women artists. I mean, there are so many we could talk about. We could talk about Arpita Singh, we could talk about Bharti Kher, talk about Nazreen Mohammadi, Sunyara Devi. But the one that I would love you to tell us about, because her story is so extraordinary, is the astonishing Amrita Shergill.
Yeah, so Amrita Shergill was absolutely incredible. She was born in 1913 in Hungary. And she was extraordinary. You know, as a teenager, she worked in Paris, you know, and because she was Indian herself, what she did was she kind of merged these cultures in her art. And so in the sort of early 20s, she painted in a such expressive way. Again, she painted self-portraits. She immortalized the Indian woman in Paris. She was the first Indian artist to attend the École des Beaux-Arts, which is an extraordinary feat, when she was a teenager. And, you know, but then as she was studying in Paris, she said, you know, she had this sort of haunting idea that she had to go back to India. She said, I can only paint in India. Europe belongs to Matisse, Picasso, and Braque. India belongs to me. She wanted to paint in her country. And as a result, what she did, she went out into the mountains and she painted people for who they were. Again, she didn't discriminate. She wanted to even kind of bring to life communities who were living in smaller villages. And her works just exude this sort of electricism in it. They exude electricity. And also, she really kind of focuses on women, especially, you know, on that sort of cusp of adolescence. It's such a complex time and something that is not seen in the story of art by Gombrich. And actually, what is it like to be an 18-year-old, you know, who has lived in Italy, in Hungary, in Paris, and then has come back to India? And she was earning great success in her mid-20s already, but you know, distraughtly, when she was 28 years old, she died very suddenly. But she left behind this extraordinary body of work. And you know, I think that's the thing. What these women did was just totally fearless. They immortalized their story and said, this is what deserves to be heard.
I mean, and it is magical. I mean, please go and look it up. Well, in fact, also by Katie's book, which is full of the most beautiful pictures, they've actually sold out at the festival. So you're going to have to buy it from Full Circle Books online. But I mean, it's so terrific to look at these works. I mean, let's talk about some of the kind of unique obstacles that women artists face. Because, I mean, as you say, for instance, being denied access to life drawing classes or anything, you know, it does change how you approach art. It does mean that you actually are, you know, not having the full range of expertise. But the story in your book, which just, again, absolutely floored me, was, of course, about Artemisia Gentileschi. So she was an artist in the Renaissance, actually one of the finest artists in the Renaissance. But, you know, this is going to be distressing, but something happened to her in 1611, which, you know, really had a huge impact on her life. You know, can you tell us about this?
Absolutely. I mean, Artemisia Gentileschi was also a rare case, because she is known for these kind of towering grand paintings that are just so visceral and bloody. She was working at the cusp of the 1600s, you know, in the sort of Baroque era, which exudes this sort of theatricalism as well. And she was born in 1593, and so much of the time, if a woman artist could for a woman to become an artist, she actually needed a powerful man looking after her. And actually, you know, let's hear it for the dads, and you know, because Artemisia's father, Orazio Gentileschi, was an incredible artist, and he let her experiment in his studio. And as a result, if she wasn't able to go to the Lyceum or go to the cathedral unchaperoned, where you'd see the most grandest paintings of the day, she was able to see them inside his studio. And she grew up grinding pigments. But of course, this was the cusp of the 17th century in Rome, and it wasn't a kind place to women. And already, age 17, she painted a picture called Susanna and the Elders. And in the West, Susanna and the Elders is this very famous story of a sort of young, virtuous woman who's bathing in her garden when two lecherous men come over and try and seduce her. And the reason why it's popular in especially European museums is because it allows for a semi-naked Susanna, essentially pornography for men. And what she did is she actually painted it from her point of view. It's a distressing painting. It's towering. It's brilliant, though, because she gives voice to what it must have been like to be a teenager in 1610 in Rome. And a year later, when she was in the studio of her father, she was raped by a friend of her artist father called Agostino Tassi. And, you know, her father didn't immediately report it. And actually, the only reason why he reported it in the end is because it brought distress on him and his own family. He wasn't looking out for her. And as a result, it resulted in an excruciating 7-month trial where she was tortured with a sort of instrument called a sibile, which is ropes tied around her fingers and tightened. I mean, the most abhorrent punishment.
And can we just clarify? Yeah. She was tortured.
Yeah.
Not the accused rapist, but her, the victim, was tortured. Can you explain why, at least, to this audience, who I'm sure are thinking, what the hell?
I mean, I'm thinking the same thing, and also to sort of ruin an artist's hand as to ruin their career. Anyway, for some reason, she overcame it, and the next year moved to Florence, and spent the rest of her career, I mean, she, you know, was called by Charles I to come to England in 1630. And she immortalized these biblical heroines, Judiths, Lucretias, Susannas, but she gave them the power. Because if you compare, for example, there's this fantastic work that I urge you all to look up called Judith Beheading Holofernes. And oftentimes in art history, Judith is kind of looking a bit passive. So in Caravaggio, although Holofernes is getting his last breaths of life, you know, he still looks mighty. And in Artemisia's, what she does, she actually switches up the story. So Judith and her maidservant, who was in the original story, was keeping watch. Actually, they're butchering this guy's head like a piece of meat. And it's this towering work, and she painted it twice. And, you know, when she also, the topic of self-portraits, she immortalized herself as St. Catherine of Alexandria, who was a saint who was rescued by divine intervention. And this was a woman who was now considered an absolute feminist icon. But how many of you have heard of her? You know, it's the fact that we need these stories to be globally recognized, because the fact that she was doing this in the early 1600s is such a feat. And personally, you know, I look to her every day.
Absolutely. And I mean, while of course we know that, you know, male artists may well have had to themselves deal with things like sexual assault, for a woman this did represent something quite different, didn't it? I mean, as you say, she had to spend 7 months defending herself. She was tortured to confirm that she was telling the truth. That was how they, for what they thought they were doing. I mean, these are sort of obstacles in life that male artists were not really having to deal with in the same way at all.
No, not at all. And also, you know, this idea of class as well, which is still a huge issue in, you know, the art world, especially where I live in London, where rents are so high. You know, it's very much, you know, looking at only a certain artist from a certain class can really actually become an artist. And also when we're looking at obstacles as well, the reason why perhaps women aren't, you know, they're not recognized with these grand sort of multi-figured paintings, although Artemisia Gentileschi was, is because they were very much reduced or restricted to sort of lower genres of art. Portraits are still life, but as I said, with Sofonisba Anguissola or Clara Peters, they monopolize these markets and switch them up. You know, for example, another one, Sofonisba Anguissola, you know, immortalized her and her sisters playing a game of chess. First of all, showing women's intellectualism, but behind them is this incredible mountainous landscape. Or, you know, if they're painting a self-portrait, they've got them also painting a full-length portrait here. So they're constantly coming up with clever and witty ways to say, this is my painting and this should be recognised.
There are so many pictures in this book and stories in this book that stop me in my tracks, but one of them is by this extraordinary early artist called Fede Galizia. And it's this miniature. Could you tell us a little about this and how this came about? Because it is so unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, so this work is called Prince Zaga Christ by Fede Galizia. And what it is, it's actually the first miniature in art history of an African man. And it's of this amazing guy called Prince Zaga Christ, who's essentially
very handsome in his picture.
And he's on his way from Ethiopia to Europe. And, you know, you can see the kind of friendship between them, because on the back of it, they've got some Amharic inscriptions. And I think that's also, you know, these works have been dismissed for so long, yet they carry with them so many stories. And you know, it's full of richness and everything. And you know, another example of a fantastic artist who has also been completely forgotten, who I only discovered recently, is someone called Edmonia Lewis. And, you know, and she was an artist working in the sort of neoclassical era in the 19th century, a bit later in America. But she made these grand sort of marble busts and full-length statues in the sort of style of neoclassicism. And she was the first African-American sculptor of any gender to achieve extraordinary success. But what she did is she switched it up, because these women seem to have just wanted to show a different side of art history. So she's got this fantastic work called Forever Free that she made 4 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. And what she did is she sculpts these two figures who are these freed slaves, you know, absolutely beautiful, and the woman is knelt on the floor and the man is holding up his fist. And actually what she's doing is she's putting her own narrative into this very historic and, you know, imbued with a lot of, you know, neoclassicism has a lot of problems with it. And so it's about sort of telling their story in the form of a classical representation.
Absolutely, and globally as well. You know, you bring in so many examples, but I was very much taken with some of the Japanese art stories, particularly Katsushika Oi. Am I pronouncing that even
yes,
slightly
absolutely.
Correct? Okay, good. Apologies to any Japanese people present for my terrible pronunciation. I mean, these women were painting. I mean, her paintings are heart-rendingly beautiful. Can you tell us a little about them?
Totally. So, I mean, you know, like I said earlier, so much of the time, women to become artists had to be the daughters of artists. And what's extraordinary about Katsushika Oi is, if I tell you who her father is, I'm sure many of you will know, Hokusai, who created the great wave of Kanagawa. And what she did is she, you know, very much worked in the style of him. Again, she was raised growing up in his studio and actually was his assistant for most of his later career. So it's actually, you know, we talk about how much the wife types up the man's letter or novel or whatever. You know, she was helping him, yet her name went into oblivion after he died. And the only way that I even found out about her was because she had this kind of secret recipe that was to kind of bring out these colours in these such electric ways, because she was kind of footnoted in the British Museum catalogue of Hokusai's a few years ago. And I was like, this is incredible. She kept this secret recipe of keeping colours underground so they would be so bright. And, you know, what she did also is she painted in this very sort of traditional way in the sort of 1850s. But it's also as though she's got this extraordinary work, which is called Cherry Blossoms at Night, which is illuminately lit. It's of a woman sort of penning a poem or writing a diary. And she's surrounded by this cherry blossom, and it's in the middle of the night as well. And what it sort of reminds me of Virginia Woolf's, you know, A Room of One's Own. And the fact that these women almost had to perform these things in secret. They had to go and work, and they had to hide while they work, because it was almost as though, because they wouldn't be accepted by the establishment or know that they could. And as a result, for me personally, when I look at the works in these books, you know, they become more experimental than ever. And I think there is something to be said about sort of working in secret, however awful and damning it is, the fact that they could just experiment in every way possible.
And talking of innovation, I mean, this is also part of the story, isn't it? That so if you have something like painting, which is very bound up in a canon, you know, and the men are denying entry, the women can't come to life classes, they can't do all of this. When new forms of art emerge, sometimes that gives women an opportunity. And I was very interested in your book in photography in this way, because photography was, you know, low valued. Women were allowed to make inroads early on, weren't they? And I mean, there's some amazing early photography by women.
Exactly. One of the earliest photographers is Julia Margaret Cameron, who was kind of working alongside the Pre-Raphaelites. And I think photography for women, you know, something that really was pioneered at the end of the 19th century, it didn't have this patriarchal history that painting and sculpture had. So really, women were invited to it. And as a result, you know, they went out in the streets with their handheld camera in the early 20th century. You know, they reported on the front line, like Lee Miller in the 1940s in World War II. But I think that's also something that I wanted to really sort of get to grips with in this book, is that, you know, we've heard of photography, sculpture, printmaking, or we've heard of big movements like impressionism or abstract expressionism, or what is minimalist art? What does it actually mean? And part of this book was also kind of taking these buzzwords and saying to people, let's actually really decode them and write them in an accessible way, and let's root them in these different subjects in order to sort of bring them to life. Like, what is the history of photography, and how has it developed in our history?
And actually, that's something you sort of bring up, isn't it? That really, what modern art means, what it is. Well, why don't you tell us? What is modern art, Katie?
So, you know, I really argue in the book that what makes art modern is actually the participation of women artists. And the word modern art is often seen, you know, at the sort of cusp of the 20th century. So kind of 1880s or 1850s, you know, up until the sort of early 20th century. And the reason for that is for the first time, like I said, women could be admitted to the life room, but they could also wander around the streets of Paris unchaperoned, which meant they could look at works in the Louvre. They could spend their time studying the marble sculptures and the plaster casts. And actually, it's up to them. For some, you know, for the first time ever, they weren't restricted by anything. They had freedoms, you know, some freedoms and some liberations. And of course, in the early 20th century, women get the vote. You know, so much changes. And as a result, they're inserting themselves into art history like never before. And suddenly, they're painting everything from their point of view. So there's a fantastic impressionist artist called Berthe Morisot. And, you know, she was working in the kind of 1870s and 1880s, just before the sort of cusp of this freedom. But she paints the complexity of motherhood. You know, how often do we see that represented by male artists? It's the fact that they are grappling with these subjects that have so often been dismissed by the canon, by the establishment, and they're saying, actually, no, these things matter. Motherhood matters. It's not all gorgeous virgin and childs. It's complex. So, for example, she paints her sister Edma in this work called The Cradle, which is extraordinary. And it's Edma who's dressed in a kind of striped blazer and these kind of ruffles, something that I would quite like to wear today. And she's clearly a modern woman, but Edma, because of marriage, had to give up her artistic career. And so it's also this really complicated painting of her looking down at her baby, who's kind of shielded with this beautiful sort of white net. And it's sort of saying, you know, do I stay in and look after you, or do I go out and see the world? And actually, these questions are still something that we're grappling with today as women across the world. These are global stories that need to be addressed and recognized. And also, I think the power of figurative painting as well is the fact that we can see who lived and who came before us, like I mentioned Amrita Shergill. And there was also this extraordinary artist called Alice Neal, who really was, the influence behind this book as well, because I saw her work at a very similar age that I started The Great Women Artists. And only she has sort of just come to light. She was born in 1900 in America, and she died in 1984. And she only really got some recognition in her 70s. And she was a portrait artist known for painting pictures of people from all different walks of life in New York City. You know, she painted those in drag. She painted her landlord's son. She painted Andy Warhol after he'd been shot. But she painted with such truth, and she painted people from all different aspects of society, of all ages and races, and she didn't discriminate. And I think that's the power of portraiture, of figurative painting, is that we actually see people who came before us. And actually, a fantastic American critic called Hilton Owls writes fantastically on Alice Neal, because he talks about seeing her painting for the first time as a young black queer man, queer boy in Crown Heights in Brooklyn, and seeing his story immortalized in paint. And I just think that, you know, I think all of us will probably find something, one work that sort of resonates in this book. And it can just be just one. That's the kind of power of it. And it will speak to us. And I think, you know, that's also why I wrote it in this kind of very accessible way, is because I want a sort of 13-year-old to pick it up in a library at their school or something and just see their story told and feel like they can also go out there and be an artist and be part of art history. And also I should mention that, you know, so many of these women as well, they were such sort of humble, yes, brilliantly bohemian, eccentric people, but they were also fantastic educators as well. And so much of the time, for example, an extraordinary artist called Ruth Asawa, working in the mid-20th century, who was of Japanese descent, she was an American, she was interned when she was a teenager. But as a result, it kind of instilled in her what the teachers in the camps instilled in her, which was this ability and need and just must to teach the younger generations. And she's actually now renowned in San Francisco because she founded this workshop called the Alvarado Arts Workshop. And what she did is she said to all these kids in San Francisco, you know, I'm going to give you baker's clay, essentially flour and water. And what she did is she got them to make these ceramics. And the power of art education and what that can do, the power of showing someone that they can be part of something, or they can make something, or, you know, that can instill children to do anything. You know, the arts are so important because you can go in any sorts of skills.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please follow or subscribe to this show wherever you're listening to this to be notified about new episodes.